I am Bob Earl. I'm delighted to be here. And, breathing, something that codependents don't do. First 5 minutes will be devoted to how to breathe. I'm real glad to be here, and I'm real grateful for Sierra Tucson. I'm very supportive of what they do out there. I just had a good friend of mine, 14 years clean and sober, go through there, and he came out fine. So that's always good testimony. And all that happened to him after 14 years of sponsorship and working in the program and going to prisons and reading the book and writing inventories is that he found her. He's looked for her for 14 years. And he found her. And about 6 months later, he's on his way for codependency treatment. As he was driving to the airport to fly to Tucson, he called me from his Mercedes on his car phone. He says, "Bobby, it's just like fucking heroin, man. It's just like heroin." Hung up the phone, got on the plane.
First I want to start about, I am very proud of the book, and I wanted to say something about Bill, because originally I sent the book off to a major publisher who supposedly was highly interested in publishing this material, recovery material, and some dame who's been to six meetings and thinks she's an expert sends me back a letter telling, if you sense a small amount of bitterness there. It's your right. telling me all the changes that would need to be made in the book in order for them it to be acceptable to what they call, quote, their general readership, unquote. And I thought, what the hell makes her think I wrote it for the general readership? You know, I mean, where's this game coming from? So I called Mike Matthews, who has the company Listen to Learn. I said, "Michael, I need to get this book published my way, what I say. I want to hire my own editor, and I don't want anybody to tamper with it. It's really important to me." And that was highly unusual, because after 20 years as a television writer, I had become a good whorer, really good. You just change what they want, change, take your check and go home in Hollywood, you know, and just shut up if you want to work and make money. And the next day, Bill O'Donnell called me and said he would be delighted and proud to publish the book my way, the way I wanted it. And so I want to thank him for that. And now, let's get down to business. So much talk about all these issues, sex addiction, love addiction, inability to be intimate, codependency, adult children, about how it's, my God, where do I go? Which group do I attend? While secretly knowing if you could split up in five parts and go to five different meetings in one night, you would belong at all of them. And be more than a little bit comfortable or uncomfortable as it goes. So about all I can share with you is my experience and my opinions and what I've come upon in doing this kind of work. Oh, by the way, for those smokers and stuff, we will break, you know, in about 45 minutes and have a cigarette, and then we're not going to drag the whole thing on for another hour and a half from here, and then we'll come back. There's three schools of thought about codependency. One is that it is a disease, much as they put alcoholism into the disease mold. The other is that it is a psychological disorder, personality disorder, brought about by being raised in an oppressive, repressive environment as a child. And the third is that it is an addiction, that is a result of what happened to us when we were children, what we had to do in order to survive. It created a set of living patterns that we were as addicted to as we were of alcohol, drugs, or anything else. They haven't come to an exact conclusion on that yet, and I'm sure the professionals will let us know exactly what it is as soon as they find out what insurance covers. I'm sort of leaning in there with the addiction group. And that's because I found that when things changed emotionally in my life, to a more functional or healthier sort of environment, I became physically uncomfortable. I would almost go through withdrawal. I would get really, really uncomfortable when things were out of my control. And control is a real major issue for those of us who have been raised in any kind of dysfunctional home. The confusion, I think, that comes between CODA and ACOA is the fact that CODA was, in essence, started for those who were adults who were raised in a dysfunctional family other than alcoholic. And so if you want to simplify all this, alcoholic family is just one more dysfunctional family. Okay? I mean, they're all... Either you had a dysfunctional family or you had a functional family, and you can go to either extreme and every little degree in between. But control is a major issue for all of us that have come out of dysfunctional families. There's a real sound reason for that. I'm going to have to figure this out, so bear with me for a minute. I hear the water in Tucson is not good for you. Is that true? That's what it says in Spanish on the bathroom wall in Santa Fe. Okay, control. An Olympic event. Sierra Tucson at some point is going to be bringing to Tucson a play. This play is entitled Family Baggage. Don't miss it. All right? And it is a brilliant, brilliant play to take people to who you perceive to have the problem of codependency that you would like to just sneak up on and get them, you know, without really, and that you know their denial is so thick that if they came to something like this, that, you know, they wouldn't hear what's being said. And in it, they had a skit about control being an Olympic event. But the play is, I mean, I'm a hard audience. I'm a tough audience. Believe me for this stuff. And they made me laugh and made me cry, and they really touched me with this play. So, but control is an Olympic event, and control is critical to the survival of adults who were raised as children in dysfunctional homes. And the very first thing that we try and do as we get a little physical stature and some experience and some intellect is we try and alter the natural rhythm of life. No small. I mean, we don't take on little things. I don't know if everybody can see this or not. I don't even know if you can hear me. Can you hear me when I wait for the microphone? No. Okay. Well, I'll go back to it in a minute. Is the natural God-given rhythm of life. Okay? Unchangeable. See, the first lie they tell you in 12-step recovery is that everything will be okay. No, it won't. Won't even be close to okay. Okay? But you can be okay. Which, of course, if you're codependent, you don't believe. Now, the issue with codependence, and I use the term codependent, you may hate it, particularly if you're an adult child of an alcoholic family, and not from one of them chicken shit, lightweight, dysfunctional workaholic families, you know. But I just use it to save a lot of unnecessary verbiage. You know, so because it really is the end, it is the end result that matters here. The codependent, in their inability to accept that, devotes all their waking and most of their sleeping energy trying to turn that into this. Now, just for a moment, think hospital. Okay? Think intensive care. Think monitor of human functions.
putting all our energy into being dead. Now, the chemically dependent person, in their frustration over their inability to take life from its natural rhythm, which is that, and turn it into that, lives much like this. That becomes familiar. And anything that becomes familiar to us, we become addicted to. So, the simple act of stopping the physical intake of the chemicals does not stop our need for this. We continue to live like this.
Nobody's laughing. We're addicted to that. Why drive 65 miles an hour and relax and enjoy your vacation when you could do 75 and watch the rearview mirror the whole way? We need that tension. That tension is familiar. And the tragedy for those of us raised in dysfunctional families is we equate familiar with safe. I mean, you see countless times people going back into terrible battering situations and you say, how the hell can they do that? Because it's familiar. And they mistake familiar for safe. So one of the things that becomes critical to us as children is control. And we learn this because control is critical to the dysfunctional parent. The parent must control the child. Now, we've got a real problem going here. Children are born with some really free, outrageous, wondrous feelings. And their behavior is anything but controlled. So now the dysfunctional parent must somehow get control of this child. They must make them obedient. Okay, we as a child desperately need the love of the parent. Our parents are emotionally unavailable and they need to control us and they need our approval. I'll try and get into all this stuff tonight. He said some of that stuff in the workshop tomorrow. But anyhow, what happens is this. I have got to stop being who I am in order to either be loved or not get killed. I mean, that basically sums up living in a dysfunctional home. But I must stop my own feelings. So many people interpret control as though I am a puppeteer and I have puppet strings and I am controlling you. My control of you isn't even close to the need I have to control me. Okay? Control, my problem with control isn't that I can't control you. My problem with control is I've got to control me. I have to live a life based on my belief system, on what I was taught as a child. So my whole life is spent controlling me, showing you somebody I want you to see. Okay? Now there can be two totally extreme reactions and two totally extreme external behaviors. There's passive and aggressive codependency. Okay? For those of you who are following the Nussbaum-Steinberg trial, that is an absolute perfect. The society could not ask for a better example of aggressive and passive codependency. And that she's the passive one and he's the aggressive one. But so many times this stuff gets confusing for us, you know, because we guys, for the most part, think codependency is an issue for them, you know? Some, them poor women that are weak and hang on your ankle as you go out the door. Well, I don't have a problem with that. I learned from my parents, just get another. It's true. Well, so the first thing you broke or the first thing you lost. If you're raised in a dysfunctional family, the immediate promise made by the family is that stop crying, get control. They got to get control of what you're feeling, your behavior. Stop crying. We'll get you another. We'll go shopping tomorrow. And for many of us, that literally becomes a way of life.
Yes.
That's perfect. See, this, somebody gave me this, I love this. This is an absolutely unacceptable concept to a codependent. Somebody has got to be to blame. Nothing just happens. Usually you will be to blame if I can work it out. If I can't, then I have to be to blame. But I would much prefer you. Well, why is all this stuff so important? Okay, so the parents couldn't stand me crying. The parents wanted me to walk around the house like a little soldier. The parents sort of did this. The parents made us line up. The parents did this. What does that really matter? Well, what it matters is this. The conclusion I've come to based on my experience, which is about 53 years of life now, a little more than, is that I am my feelings. That's who I am. Now, there are a lot of wonderful schools of thought. There's one, of course, the metaphysical, powerful, and I am spirit. I've tried soaring like a spirit in recovery. I've worked hard. I went through a couple of 3 years of structured, serious meditation, getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning to get 4 hours of meditation in before starting my day. I mean, when I found the Self-Realization Fellowship, I was in heaven. Because you just sort of leave the planet through their meditation process. I was in love. I mean, leading is my very favorite pastime. I've had women say to me, I could love you more, God damn it, if there was somebody in there. I just shrug. When I find him, I'll tell you, you know? So I tried soaring like an eagle with the rest of the spiritual giants and failed miserably because my control system or navigational system was prepared for me by my parents. So it seemed that I kept flying into the sides of buildings from my past constantly. And I came to the conclusion of what I was by figuring out what I'm not. I'm not my automobile, because, you know, you can go out and that will be gone. Bye-bye, out of the parking lot. The odds of your car being gone increase each day that you're alive. I'm certainly not my job. I can lose it. The company can fold. I can change my career. I can do any number of things. So I'm not what I do for a living, because I'm still here when that changes. I am not my clothes, because I could go in a phase Sunday and, could be all be gone. I'd still be here. And would probably buy different clothes. I'm not my house. My house would certainly burn down or be destroyed or taken away from me or God knows what else. It would be gone and I would still be here. I am not my physical body, because I have had friends who have lost extremities and come out more alive and more powerful and more real as a result of losing an arm or losing two legs than they were before they lost it. So I'm certainly not my body, because pieces of it can go, and I'm still here. I don't seem to be spirit floating around the universe. Seems God put me here in this body. So I came to the conclusion 2 or 3 years ago, I am my feelings. That's who I am. And that's, of course, the thing I've run from all my life. Now, I am the father of an 11-month-old baby daughter, and I want to tell you, I am convinced now, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that I am my feelings, and I'll tell you how I arrived at this conclusion. By watching my baby daughter be born and watching the first 2 or 3 months of her life, she arrived on this planet with a full set of feelings. God delivered this beautiful, angelic, blue-eyed little angel with a whole package of feelings. She didn't learn any of them. She came with all of them. She had an energy all of her own. She can laugh so hard, her whole body shakes. When's the last time you laughed so hard, your whole body shook? Most of us, because we're so in control, laugh like
That's funny.
Horrendous fear we have of looking silly, you know, so we can't laugh till the whole body. She cries, oh my God, can she sob? Oh, tears, old tears. And oh my God, this child of God, this little girl, this little angel gets angry. The A word. Anger must be controlled at all costs. Get a lot of support for that, depending on your home group. I have a best friend who says it might serve us. See, part of the problem is we love to live in fantasy lands. We're codependency, and new information comes in every day, and new ideas, and people find new things out. And functional people can avail themselves of new information. Dysfunctional people try and pretend it's not there. Right? And my best friend, I've got a classic line. He says it might serve us all really well to remember that the line that anger is the dubious luxury of normal men was written by a manic depressive scam artist who killed himself with cigarettes. And that's not disrespectful. It just happens to be factual. And he's not saying it as a slam. He's saying, let's look at where we get this information from. Because the number one problem for those of us raised in dysfunctional families is our belief system. It's what we believe to be true when it's not true. My whole workshop that I do tomorrow is designed specifically based on the theory that those of us raised in alcoholic and dysfunctional families are so well defended that we got to sneak up on ourselves to find out who the hell we are. I mean, there's no coming straight on and saying, you are up. It's like the walls drop, the veil goes, we split off and leave our bodies and go bye-bye, you know, and they're talking to an empty vessel. All right, so I have a design that just kind of comes up behind you like a mugger. And when the day's all over, you walk out going, God, I didn't know I felt that way about that. Did I really write that? Is this me? But anyway, this angelic, incredible, beautiful little girl is capable of anger. She is capable of so much anger, she doubles her fists up until she cuts off the circulation. They turn blue. She furrows her brow. She screams so hard and holds her breath and she gets bright red. Her whole face, except one spot right here, which stays white because she's got it so tight she's even cut the blood flow off there. Now this is this little child gift from God's capacity for anger. She becomes totally involved in it. And it also is very short-lived. We don't tamper with it. When she blows a fit, we let her blow a fit. We just grade it on a scale from 1 to 10. You know? And let her blow her fit. And it's over like that. But when I step it down, when I control my anger, God is with me 40 years later. I still got it. So everybody then begins to consider me a person who overreacts for no reason at all. Well, I'm overreacting because you pissed me off and I have 40 years of unresolved anger here. And there's nothing I like more than being right. Because if I can just be right for 5 minutes, I can really dump a lot of old stuff on you. You know? So I will work very hard to maneuver myself into a situation, whether it's with the lady at the dry cleaning store or the guy at the gas station, but somebody, so I can be right. And if I can set you up to be right, boy, should I let you have it. I can give you looks that will kill. I can weather you down. How dare you ruin my only good shirt, you son of a bitch. I need it for tonight. This is the most important occasion of my life. You see the spot on my shirt? How could you?
I mean, I'm back to where they gave my train away, you know.
This little angel, my baby daughter, cries at the drop of a hat. When she cries, she stops. Her whole body is involved. Well, I'm like most guys in this audience tonight, I'm sure. I don't know how you learn not to cry. I know how I learn not to cry. My old man knocked me dead on my ass. I said, okay, this is not a good emotion here. Hell, I can skip this one for a while. And of course, for most of you women, I mean, as a rule, now there's always exceptions to the rule, but as a rule, women will cover their anger with sadness. In other words, ladies, you will cry rather than punch the wall or throw dishes and have a fit, and we men will cover our sadness with anger. We would rather punch the wall than sit down and cry. I can never remember a session with my therapist where, in getting into the anger and being on my knees and pounding and screaming the pillows, that the very end result of the expression of all that anger wasn't me laying on the floor in a little ball crying, because what I was really covering up was the terrible sadness done to me when I was small and the pain and all of that coupled into a package. And that was what it was about. So when I punch walls, that's so I don't have to cry. That's all. I just don't want to cry. I don't want to let you really see me. And that's a tragedy, because that's what intimacy is. Me being me and letting you see me. That's how complicated that one is, by the way. I know there's a lot of books and workshops on it, but it really gets down to me being me and letting you see me. So, as a child, I came here with all this explosion of feelings. I was really alive, man. I was a little bundle of energy. And on top of that, you notice how many of you, I want to see a show of hands. The minute you hear that baby make a noise, you instinctively want to look to see where it is. How many? Come on, you hear the baby, you want to look to see. That's because babies... This is, comes from, of course, I live in Santa Fe, so you got to take all this crap with a grain of salt, okay? I mean, I live in the New Age center of the world, which means unconsciousness at its best, all right? I'm serious, man. I mean, we got a population of 55,000 and 3 Zen Buddhist temples. Whoa. We got a lot of people who aren't here, you know. Fred, that car just ran over your feet. I know, but it's not an issue unless I allow myself to become involved in things on this plane, you know. So, hey, I love this stuff. Anyhow, so anyway... They say that children, babies, cry on a level of communication that's called alpha. And it is for their protection. And it is because they cry at that level that you, as an adult, instinctively want to turn to the crying and see where they are. That is entirely for their survival. And it's entirely for their protection that they cry on that level. That's why they drive. I've seen speakers go nuts with kids in the audience. Just nuts. That's because they don't understand what's happening. They don't understand. They're trying to communicate intellectually from their brain, and these little gremlins making noises are pulling at them down here, you know. So they just come unwound at the lecture instead of dealing with it. So, anyway, back to I arrive. Oh, now the other thing that I arrived with as a baby, and my little daughters arrived with, is the capacity to make her needs known. And we're talking not shy about this one at all, okay? She has different cries for different needs, and different cries for how long we ignore the need. Little needs, little cries. You know, bigger need, bigger cry. Big need. Big need ignored. Now, there is both in our recovery community and in society a belief system that is lethal. And that belief system says this. In society it says, to be emotionally healthy is to be not needy.
It's true. And in a recovering community, it is to be recovered.
To be recovered is to be not needy.
Okay? True. That's a lie. True. Truth is, emotional health is to know what your needs are and to be able to get them met.
Whoa.
To know what your needs are and to be able to get them met. That's functional. That's emotionally healthy. Babies arrive with that capacity. When was the last time, if you are even know what the hell your needs are? I'm one of the old frozen feeling guys. I could be standing there on fire and somebody could say, Bob, what do you need? Nothing, man, it's cool. So I had no idea what the hell my needs were. You know, how you feeling? About what? About the fact your wife is in the other room packing. I don't know. But I wouldn't tell you I don't know. I tell it's God's will. So what the hell happened that I'm born with all these feelings, the ability to express my feelings, and the ability to express my neediness, and I grow into an adult who spends his whole life pretending he's okay when he's anything but okay. In order to do that, I have to exercise tremendous control over me. And I learned to exercise control in my home so I wouldn't get killed. In my home, my father was the alcoholic. My mother was the child beater. Not uncommon for the non-alcoholic parent to be the abuser. And it's real common to not be able to remember it. The reason for that is the behavior of the alcoholic parent is so irrational that the child so desperately needs for the non-drinking parent to bring some form of stability into the home, that the fact when the non-drinking parent turns into the child beater, we just repress it completely. So that by the time we grow up, I never recall it. Had you asked me, I would have said, you know, I remember my old man kicking my ass a couple of times and my mother never hit me. And what eventually came out through a lot of work is my mother beat me senseless for the first 5 years of my life. I missed so much school my first year, they wouldn't even give me a grade. Now, the interesting thing about this is, when I discovered that, I was going through old report cards, and I wasn't working on these issues yet, so I was still into my own denial, and I want, you know, you got to tell me what keeps me comfortable. I like comfort. Now, comfort for me can be sitting in the middle of a fire, okay? A functional person would say, boy, your life looks very stressful. I'm fine, okay? And I'd appreciate if you don't call it to my attention, okay? Because I'm working real hard not to look at it. You know, I'm just like this, so I don't have to look at the truth of my life, okay? And I had so much fun with that one, I forgot where I was going with it. Oh, thank you! So I'm going through my report cards, and I find this report card that says, you know, they refuse to give me a grade because I missed so much school. So I said to my mom, Mom, God, I missed so much school during my first year, they wouldn't give me a grade. What happened? She said, I don't know, I guess you were sick. I said, oh, okay. That was it. That was the end of the conversation. Now you want to tell me, I'm the only child. Okay? You want to tell me that your only child misses so much school, their first year of school, they don't get a grade, misses months of school, and you don't remember? Okay, that was okay with me. I don't want to know the answer. Don't tell me. I'll have to do something. And if I find out any new information, it means I'm going to have to do something. And the core issue
issue for me is I don't think I can do it. Because I don't think I have whatever it takes. Because my self-esteem is so low. My shame is so great. I can't let you give me new information that might spur me into taking new actions because I know I'm going to fail at the action. Because I'm from a dysfunctional family and I'm a dysfunctional adult and control is critical to me. And from a functional human being, succeeding is unimportant. Giving it a shot is all they care about. You want to know what a functional family is like? By the way, they do exist. The fact that they don't exist is a lie. Do you not know any of them?
I didn't either before I got here. There's real good reasons for that. They don't hang out with us. We're very stressful people for them to be around, you know. They can walk into one of our really rigid, controlled, you know, workaholic or real rigid, controlling, dysfunctional families. Everybody's sitting neatly, quietly, politely at the table, food being served. They sit down for about 4 seconds and go, I think I gotta go. Because they live off feelings and intuition. I've met some functional people, and no, there's a flip side of that. Besides, when I'm into my codependency, when I'm into those issues, when I'm into control and the rest of that horseshit and denial and all of it, they bore me to tears. Functional people bore me to tears. They don't have enough sense to know anything about anything. Their first big problem is that they don't know that they aren't okay. The foundation of a functional family is unconditional love. Okay? Let me explain unconditional love for a second, just in case you don't know. Unconditional love means that your parents love you regardless of your behavior. Their love is not conditioned upon their approval of your actions. In a dysfunctional family, what love is available, and usually there's not a lot, because most dysfunctional parents are emotionally unavailable, just not home, is usually used as a means of control. If you behave in a manner in which they want you to behave, you will get what love there is to have. And if you do not behave in a manner in which they want you to behave, they will pull back what little love there is from you, and you will feel it, and it is very painful. Because I'm convinced that we arrive in this world as children not only needing love, but knowing what it is. I believe babies arrive knowing what love is. And that's why it's so painful for us when it's not there. And that's why it has such dire consequences on us as an adult. The fact that it wasn't there when we were children. See, God delivered us here perfect. But something happened. I've spent the last 9 years of my recovery trying to get back to being the child that God had created me to be in the first place. That's what all this work is really about. Getting back to being a child. Getting back to being my feelings and able to express them. Being able to say, no, I'm not big and strong and all powerful, and it doesn't matter if my foot on fire and somebody comes out some water. You know, and I got any water out there. It's about becoming this child again. I heard a beautiful story not long ago. When the baby was first born, I mean, my wife and I had no idea what the hell was going to be. We had a lot of books and we talked to a lot of people, but, you know, this was not anything either one of us had foreseen in our lives, in our sobriety. And when this baby was born, my wife's mother was smart enough to send us a nurse to be with us for 3 hours a day for the first 3 weeks. Very smart move. Anyway, wonderful nurse, calmed all our fears, because we were the typical crazy parents every time she made a noise. I was like, oh, God, what's wrong? You know, we're both in there. Oh, my God, you know, it's terrible, you know, and checking the consistency of her bowel movements. I mean, it's like, you know, baby shit becomes your entire conversation, you know, the first 2 years. It's like, just suddenly from a reasonably intelligent human being with a capacity to converse with another intelligent, I could only talk to people who had babies. Nobody else even wanted me around, right, you know. So we're going through all that, and this nurse saved our life by calming all our fears and stuff. And I ran into her about 3 months ago,
And she's telling me an incredibly wonderful story. I like this woman a lot. She was just one of these functional, gentle souls. She was really beautiful.
And she was working in another home where they had a little baby girl. They had a 3-year-old baby boy. And they were sitting, she was sitting in the kitchen with a mother, and the baby was asleep in the nursery. And the 3-year-old little boy came walking through the house, very intent, right to the nursery. Opened the door and went in. Now, the family had been really functional. I mean, he knew where babies came from, and he'd been able to feel the baby and his mom, and he'd been there for the delivery, and he's got his own time and his quality time from mom and from dad and from everybody else. And they thought, maybe they better follow him in there anyway, because it might be he was going in to say, I got my mom, when is yours going to show up, So I follow him to the door, which was still open a crack because he hadn't closed it tight. And he stood there waiting for this little baby to wake up for over 15 minutes. Didn't make a sound, didn't say a word, didn't shake her bassinet, nothing. Stood there looking at the baby. And finally his baby sister, who was just a few weeks old, I think 3 weeks old or something, opened her eyes. And this little guy said to her, tell me about God. I'm almost 3 now, and I forgot a lot. And I have a friend in Santa Fe, and she told me this story once. I love this story. She was in a commune in Denver, Colorado, in the mountains, and she had her baby daughter. Her lap was about 2.5 years old. And she was crying, and she was looking down at this baby. And she said, I'm sorry. I am so sorry. I'm sorry I brought you into this world. I'm sorry your father is your father. I'm sorry that we're in this goddamn community, these weird people in these mountains. I'm sorry I couldn't have given you better or done better. It breaks my heart that I brought you into this. And this little baby girl, that matter of 10, 2.5 years old. It's okay, I'm here to help you. Okay, I'm going to help you. This little baby girl nowadays is 14 years old, 6 feet tall, and one of the most incredibly beautiful creatures you've ever met in your life. What a kid. So what happened is, somewhere we forgot the message. Children are put here to teach us. We've got distorted. We thought they're here for us to teach them. There's a brilliant book about these issues, other than mine, called For Your Own Good, written by Alice Miller, a German psychiatrist. It really explains dysfunction. It really explains where it came from. She quotes in there out of a child rearing manual that is 300 years old. And the whole focus of those child rearing manuals was get control of the child. And get it immediately. And any means required to get control of the child is okay. You are doing the child a favor. You are saving the child from their intuitive self, which is dangerous. So this stuff is new. It came from a long time ago. Okay.